want to say something? Thanks, Dennis. So today we're starting a new subtopic of our course, which would be the quantum Hall effect. The quantum Hall effect was discovered experimentally in 1980 by Klaus von Klissing, who received the Nobel Prize in 1985. Actually, in the core of the quantum Hall effect, there are Landau levels, which we're going to learn today, which were known for some time, but have never been seen in any material until the discovery of the quantum Hall effect. And this is a field that was very popular at the in the 80s. People, right away after the discovery, started to make a lot of theoretical progress, and soon after the integer quantum Hall effect, which was discovered in 1980, I think it was just 1982 or something, the fractional quantum Hall effect was discovered and provided work for many people for a long time. And I think about 10 years ago, people started to think that maybe there are not so many new open problems, and they moved on to other problems. But more recently, in the past 5 years, since we had the topological insulators, there is revived interest in the quantum Hall effect because of very strong analogies. So since we're starting a new topic today, which might seem kind of unrelated to graphene at first, but I just want to say that there is some theme to all of this course. And in physics in general, and also very strongly in condensed matter, analogies are very powerful. And we'll see, I hope, towards the end of the course, how things are very similar if you look at them in the correct way. And you can actually gain a lot of insight if you go from one system to the other and try to make an analogy. But first of all, before we go into the quantum Hall effect, I want to talk about the classical Hall effect, which you probably covered in undergraduate, which basically tells you that in a magnetic field, if you drive current, you experience conductivity, you apply voltage, let's say, in the x direction, and you can measure current in the y direction as well as the x direction. And this is due to the Lorentz force. So let me just do a very classical thing and just write the equations of motion. So I think you did that in John's course for just an electric field. So I can think that I have an electric field. And I want to add also some force. And this force, in general, could be anything. But I want to think of it as just a damping force. So if I will have some momentum, it will want to be always opposite to the momentum. So if you want, this is some sort of an empirical fact. And if we have a magnetic field, we add V cross B, where V is the velocity. And I'm working in SI units, so there's no factor of the speed of light anywhere. Now, if we forget for a second about the damping force and the electric field, and we just think of what is the motion in magnetic field, I hope you all remember that I can write it as a time-dependent trajectory that would have some, I call it LB, would be the radius. And it will have actually a special meaning in the quantum Hall effect, but here it's just the radius. And let's say this goes like cosine. Omega C would be the cyclotron frequency, and Y would be just the sine. So I'm putting my x-axis on where when we start the motion. And if you take the derivatives and plug it in to this equation without any external force, you'll find that this is indeed a good solution. And you'll find that LB is the initial velocity over omega c. So basically, the radius here is just determined from the initial condition. So you have a particle, it's moving with some initial velocity, and this determines, and the frequency is set, so I should say omega c is Eb over m. So the frequency is set by the magnetic field, and therefore you have a radius. So this is our classical picture, and it's kind of useful. In the quantum Hall effect, we'll see that we have wave functions that are sort of localized in a region that is determined by LB, which will not be just determined by initial conditions. Yeah. I didn't use it here. F0 would be a damping force. So, for example, I think you did it, but if not, I can do it very quickly. Let's say I have P dot is force, and I will have minus EE, and I will have minus some friction. So I will have minus some P times some coefficient. That would be a damping force. Okay? So this I would call F. And you can take this alpha, if you take this alpha, and I think you did it with John, to be 1 over tau, that will give you a conductivity, which is m e squared tau over m. And the way to get that would be to solve this. So let me solve it, and you know that I have two kinds of solutions. So I need to solve the equation, the homogeneous equation, so I forget about this, and then I add a specific solution to the equation with this. So the homogeneous equation will just give me some transient solution, minus t over tau. So you can see that if I take the derivative, I get something that is exactly this. Okay, so these two, this solves the equation P dot is equal to minus P over tau. Okay? So I solve this, but I also have to add some other specific solution, which I will be EE. So I will take a constant. Okay? EE tau. Right? Because if I take this constant, I get that. And then the current density would be E over M times this P times the number of particles I have. Okay? So this is just the velocity times the charge times the number of particles. And if you actually take the average, you can forget about the transient solution, and you just put the constant, and you get this kind of Drude conductivity. So this is very classical. This is just assuming that all of the electrons are traveling. I can actually do the same kind of analysis with the extra term in my, I can add here E V cross B. So actually, let me just write it somewhere else. I'll just do it here. Minus EE minus EV cross B minus P over tau. V, let me call it P over M. And let's assume now that we have a two-dimensional system and that the magnetic field is in the Z direction. So, this is Canada. I can say it's in the Z direction. So what I have here is minus EE minus omega C P cross Z. minus 1 over tau p. And I can do the same. I just have to break it to components. So I have px dot. And let's say that I take E to be E in the x direction. Okay, so there's no electric field in the y direction. And now I just want to measure the conductivity both in the x direction and in the y direction. Okay, because I have magnetoresistance. So in the x direction, I have minus EE. And now in the x direction, I get PY. Minus omega C PY minus 1 over tau PX. And for the y direction, I don't have this. I do have omega C PX, but with a different sign, okay? Because it's P cross Z. So it's PX in the y direction and minus PY in the x direction, or the other way around. Minus 1 over tau py. And again, I can solve, but since I have the coupled equations, let me manipulate this one a little bit first. So this one tells me that px is 1 over omega c times py dot plus 1 over tau py. And let me take the derivative and plug it in here. So let's say this is 1 and this is 2. So 2 inside 1 gives me that. So px would be 1 over omega c py. And now I need to take the derivative. So I have two dots here plus 1 over tau py dot is equal to minus ee. Minus omega c py minus 1 over tau px. So I'm taking px again. So I have minus 1 over tau omega c py dot plus 1 over tau py. Okay? And now, instead of solving all of this, let me just say that I know already from this exercise that the transient solutions don't matter. So let me just look for that constant solution to do it a little faster. So anything with a dot on it, I just set to 0. And what I have is that 0 is equal minus EE minus omega CPY minus 1 over tau squared omega c py. So from this I can read off sigma xy, the off-diagonal conductivity, because I have E in the x direction and I can measure the current in the y direction. So for that I'm going to need the average of py, and py here will be EE, and I need to divide it by omega C plus 1 over tau squared omega C. So to the minus 1 here. Okay? And if I plug it in this kind of equation, I get that sigma xy is actually, and I just want to write it in a similar way to what we did before, n e squared tau over m, but then it's multiplied by omega c tau over 1 plus omega c squared tau squared. So I kind of skipped a few stages, but all I did was basically put this inside this. And then I divided by the electric field to find the conductivity. Is that okay? Now, if I want sigma xx, all I need to do is go back to the px in terms of py, and I can get sigma xx. And the classical result is the following, that sigma, and now this is not a Pauli matrix, but it is a 2x2 matrix. Sigma, the conductivity, is n e squared tau over m, like we're used to, times 1 over 1 plus omega c squared tau squared, 1 omega c tau minus omega c tau. Okay? So this is the classical Drude conductivity, which we derived assuming we have collisions that just damp our system, and that the time between collisions is tau. And this is what we found. Now, in the limit of, let's say, a clean limit, where this time tau allows for many, many cyclotron motions to happen. So I want the limit of tau is much larger than omega c to the minus 1, so tau omega c is much larger than 1. Then I notice that sigma xy is, so now I just neglect this 1 with respect to omega c tau squared, and I get that sigma xy is n e squared tau over m times 1 over omega c tau. And now let me just rewrite it and say the following, it's n e squared over m times eb over m, which is omega c. And I get n e over b. And this is a huge advantage, that the scattering length time basically canceled here. And if I know the magnetic field, because I'm doing an experiment where the magnetic field comes from the experimental setup, then this is another way of measuring the number of carriers in our system. And actually, it even carries out to quantum systems. This is a good way of measuring the number of carriers. And it's you know that in band systems, sometimes the carriers are electrons and sometimes they are holes. Or you can always look at them as electrons, but you have to count empty states and filled states. And the sign of sigma xy will actually tell you what you have more. Do you have more holes or you have more particles? And another interesting point that is also beneficial to us is the fact that we're in two dimensions. So we like to talk about sigma xy because it's a microscopic kind of quantity, but usually what experiments are measuring is the conductance. So they don't apply a current density in a field, they apply voltage and current. But in sigma xy in two dimensions, it's actually the same. So if I wanted, so let's say I have I is equal to GV, okay? And G is the conductance. So this will be, but let's say that this is Y and this is X. And my sample looks like that. It has some LY, LX, okay? So the current density is J. I need to multiply it by LY. Oh, sorry, I need to multiply by LX if my current is in this direction, okay, in the Y direction. So I is LX times JY, and then I have G, but V, the voltage that I'm applying here, is actually E times LX. So then I found that JY is GE, but what we, GEX. So G is also sigma XY. So basically, what you measure is the microscopic quantity. So that only happens in two dimension and only in the longitudinal, in the off diagonal piece of the conductivity. And actually, that's crucial because later on we'll see that the quantum Hall effect gives you some very definite answer to what is the off diagonal conductivity. And it's so accurate because it's insensitive of microscopic details that it's actually today a standard for accuracy and resistivity. You can always, in an experimental setup, you can always use a quantum Hall system to calibrate your system. Okay. So I think we're kind of done with the classical piece, and we can go on to the quantum. Can I erase all of that? This one?
Just a very long one.
Just this?
Yeah.
Okay. If I just yell, if I erase something, I shouldn't. Maybe I should also mention that in band structure systems, a pretty good description, take a three-dimensional system and you apply magnetic field and the field is not strong, so we're not in the quantum Hall regime, which we'll get to in a second. Actually, it turns out that you can do something semi-classic. You can think of that V cross B as V being the group velocity. The group velocity is dE dk, roughly, right? Or dE dp, since there's none of each bar. Which tells you that if this is crossed by z and you're in some direction, some plane, then if I have, let's say, a Fermi surface, some Fermi surface in three dimensions, the motion here is going to be along the cross section. So let me just draw some crazy three-dimensional Fermi surface. Let's say I'm applying B here. This will slice my Fermi surface in the direction perpendicular to the magnetic field, and the motion, I can think of a semi-classical motion around on the Fermi surface in the plane perpendicular to the field. Yeah. Right. But the direction is the direction. So I apply the field in, okay, we wrote everything like that. P dot is equal to blah, blah, blah. So I have V cross B here, or if you want P cross Z EB, right?
Oh, okay.
So over M. Right? So I'm just thinking about it semi-classically as equation of motion in momentum space. This is just a side. It's not relevant to what I'm going to say. But I can think of wave packets in momentum space just circulating here. And what this is telling me is that I never go away out of the Fermi surface. Or if you want, this force actually conserves the energy. It does not change the energy. It only changes the direction of momentum. And the motion is always going to be around the Fermi surface if I think that action only happens on the Fermi surface because this is where electrons can actually move. The full levels, they just don't do anything. But then if you add to that a quantum perspective and you think that the wave packet should, the wave function should go back to itself after it traveled along this line, you actually find that there are oscillations. So if I plot everything versus 1 over magnetic field, and everything could be, for example, resistivity, you'll find that there are oscillations with period that is proportional, the frequency of oscillation is proportional to this area here, to the area of the Fermi surface that, of the cross section of the Fermi surface perpendicular to the magnetic field. I'm not giving you all the details, but this has been used for a long, long time to actually measure Fermi surfaces. So basically, all you have to do is change the direction of the magnetic field and measure the oscillations as you change the magnetic field, and that gives you that, let's call it AK, the area. But this is just a side. Let's go into the quantum. Let's start the quantum Hall effect. So first, I just want to think continuum particles in free space, and I'm just adding a magnetic field. So let's say B is B times Z. So I want to take a gauge A, which would be 0x times B. Say minus x times B. Okay? So now, if I started with a free Hamiltonian, then what I'll have now is px squared over 2m plus py minus ea. So my ea would be eb and minus x, so I'll have bx here, over 2m. So this is all, this is everything that the gauge field gave me. But now I want to look at it in a familiar way. So I can rewrite this in the following way. I can write px squared over 2m plus half a k, and this is some constant, x plus x naught squared. So do you know how to solve this? This is something we know how to solve. So whenever you can reduce your problem to the harmonic oscillator, you're in good shape. So let's just first define what are the constants. So k, k would be eb squared over m, and x naught would be py would be actually ky. So let me just define py is h bar ky. Ky lb squared, just because this is easy to remember. Lb squared is h bar over eb. Okay, so all of that just comes from comparing the two lines. Okay, so this is my spring constant, and this is the typical length in the problem. And I called it LB squared because it's going to have a similar role as the LB that we had before. And this is the shift. So what are the solutions to this Hamiltonian? What are the wave functions? Py disappeared. I can choose any Py I want, okay? But for a given Py, I just get this shift in the center of the harmonic oscillator. So my wave functions, ky, so let me, x and ky. I Fourier transform in K, I can do that because nothing depends on K except for this X naught. And what I'll have is the eigenstates of the harmonic oscillators, which are the Hermite polynomials, but instead of x, they're going to be of x plus x naught. So shifted times e to the minus x plus x naught squared over 2lb squared. So I didn't really do all of the steps, but this is another example where an analogy helps a lot. But now let's think of the physical picture. What we got basically are quantized levels, and let's maybe write the dispersion also. So En is going to be h bar omega c n plus half. And the reason I have h bar omega c is you remember that there's always a frequency that is square root. Let's just see that everything works fine. Maybe the classical connectivity can go away. So let's see what is this omega c. So omega c is always square root of k over m, m over k. Yeah, no, k over m, which would give us eb squared over m squared, which is eb over m, which is the same cyclotron frequency that we already defined in the classical case. But this time, it is actually the level quantization. So before, we had many states. So let's think of a particular Py or Ky. The density of states without magnetic field, if we just had a quantum system with free particles, it would just be distributed, or actually it was, yeah, it depends on the dimensionality. In two dimensions, it's kind of constant, the density of states of free particles. And maybe there's a bandwidth above which it just ends. But what we got instead is levels, sharp levels. And the separation between levels is h bar omega c. So that would be the 0, 1, 2, and the distance here is half. So h bar omega c, so it's proportional to the magnetic field. The magnetic field, when it's larger, the levels would be more spread apart. Now, what do the states look like? For every given Py, I just get some Gaussian. And let's say we're in the lowest Landau level, the n equals 0 Landau level. We still have a non-zero energy because of zero-point motion. And what we'll have is for every Py, a Gaussian. And the Gaussians are going to be somewhere along the x direction. This is the density of states. So now I'm assuming that, you know, I solved it for one free particle. But now if I had a bunch of fermions that I needed to put them there, I would just fill up those free particle states. And in two dimensions, you can do the calculation. So d of E is just, you know, going over, let's say, all of the momenta, if you want, and asking what has energy E, okay? So in two dimensions, it turns out to be flat if you just take a parabolic system. But all of this spectrum collapsed into that. So now, just from knowing that I didn't lose any states, I know that there's a massive degeneracy for each one of these states. Unless, you know, many things can happen. Maybe we only put one state here and pushed everything away, but it's more likely to think that, you know, whatever was here sort of collapsed to this, and whatever was here collapsed here. So we should have degeneracy. So let's just try to calculate the degeneracy. So where does the degeneracy, if you look at the states, where does the degeneracy come from? So we have Gaussians. Yeah, exactly. So we have Gaussians in various places along the x direction. Okay? So for a single Landau level, let's say the zeroth, it's just a Gaussian. The other Landau levels have some polynomial structure. But in the x direction, it looks kind of localized. Where is it localized in the x direction is a different question. Also, I forgot to write that there's another factor, e to the I k y y, OK? Because I already Fourier transformed, already thought that everything is translational invariance in the y direction. So how many ky's do I have? First, I need to know what is this, or I want to ask how many Gaussians I have. So I want to calculate basically how much room I have to add Gaussians there. So if my system has dimension Lx in the x direction, I want to divide it by delta x. So this would be the, you know, let's say, the lambda level degeneracy. So Lx over delta x. And what is delta x? So delta x is Lb squared times delta k. Okay? And delta k is 2 pi over Ly. Okay? So in momentum space, I have momenta 2 pi over Ly. This is like a closed box. And times an index n, right? And the index n can go from minus Ly to Ly. Is that okay? Why is that delta x? So x is Lb squared k, OK? This is what we found here, x naught. Where I put my Gaussian, I put it on x naught, right? Now I want to move it. So I'm asking between x naught 1 and x naught 2, what is this distance? I call it delta x. But it's actually dependent upon the distance in momentum space, so delta ky. And delta ky is 2 pi over ly. Okay, this is the distance, if I think of all of the particle in a box momenta that I can put there. So then, if I plug this in, I get lx over 2 pi lb squared and have ly. So if you want, this is just your sample area over 2 pi Lb squared. And the lambda level degeneracy per unit area is just 2 pi over Lb squared. And I can also write it in a different way. So let's call it area 2 pi h bar over Eb is Lb squared. Okay, so I just wrote it in, I just wrote Lb squared explicitly. This is h. So h over E is a flux quantum. So what I get is that I have area times B. This is the flux. And I have H over E, which is a flux quantum. So the degeneracy of each Landau level is how many flux quanta I can put in my system. Okay? So if I apply enough magnetic field to put n flux quantum in my system, this is going to be the degeneracy of the Landau level. And it's usually very, very big. Okay, so is that, yeah.
What really happens to that question if we choose another gauge, as it's not that gauge?
We can solve it in many gauges, and that's a good question, because I chose one gauge, and I'm telling you all of that story about how, you know, things look like. You can choose a different gauge, and we're actually going to do it for the fractional quantum Hall effect. This gives us one picture, and it gives a pretty intuitive picture when we think of conductivity, and we'll do that in a second. You can solve it. It's not, the spectrum is not gauge dependent. The wave functions are gauge dependent. But anything we'll measure, you'll measure is not going to depend on it. This is just a convenient gauge, and it's called the Landau gauge. Okay, so let's now, for this case, calculate the conductivity. Let me first make a little prediction based on the classical case. I'm interested in sigma xy, and in the classical case, I told you this is Ne over B. Classical. So let me replace N let me just write N in the following way. So nu is going to be how many Landau levels are full. And then I'm going to multiply by the degeneracy of the Landau level, okay, per unit area, times E over B. And what I get is the following. I get nu times which one should I take? Times 1 over 2 pi LB squared times E over B. And I just want to do this exercise. So I have H over EB here times E over B. And I get the following result. I get the nu times E squared over H. So this time it's not H bar. So this is sigma xy if I assume that the classical expression still works. And the way that I counted the number, the electrons per unit area is that I put the number of Landau levels that are full times the degeneracy of Landau level. Now, have you ever seen E squared over H appear anywhere? So E squared over H is what we call the quantum of conductance. And it turns out, maybe I'll put something about it in the notes, but I don't have time to go over it. It turns out that if you imagine having a quantum system with only one state, and you want to drive current through it, then you'll find that the conductivity or conductance, depending on what you measure, is E squared over H. So it looks like, in this case, as if we have new quantum levels. So for each Landau level, we have only one channel to conduct. So let me just repeat that briefly in a different way, say it in a different way, by an illustration. So if, let's say I have my system, and it only has one level that electrons can occupy, and I call it epsilon. Now I want to drive a current. So what do? I attach leads to it. So this is another lead, and this is another lead, and they're related. And this has many, many states, and they're full up to mu 1. And this has many states, and they're full up to mu 2. And mu 1 minus mu 2 is the voltage that I'm applying, okay? Because just another way to look at voltage is to say that I'm increasing the chemical potential on one side and decreasing on the other side. And now what do I expect? According to this chemical potential, this level should be full. According to this chemical potential, this level should be empty. So basically, electrons will hop in and out of the system and will get current. If you do the calculation, you'll find that the current is actually E squared over H times this mu 2 minus mu 1 times V. EV. That's fine. So basically, this is the conductance or conductivity in two dimension of one quantum channel. And what we got from just manipulating the classical conductivity is that the quantum Hall state gives us mu times the quantum of conductance. So it looks as if only one quantum state out of the huge degeneracy that we found in the quantum Hall in each lambda level, there's only one state that actually conducts something in the y direction. So we apply the field. Again, this is measuring sigma xy. So it's like applying a field in the x direction, getting conductivity in the y direction. Okay? And maybe before I go on, I'll just tell you what is seen in experiments. So if I look at sigma xy, basically what I find is something like that, a staircase, where this would be E squared over H. This would be 2 E squared over H, and so on. And this would be for different fields. And I think the best is to plot it versus 1 over H. Well, yeah, I guess it's different fields, but each field corresponds to changing the magnetic field such that more levels go into the filled state. So I can think of, if you want, this density of states, I can say that my chemical potential is somewhere. If I put it here, there's only one full level. If I put it here, there are 3 full levels. And now, instead of changing the chemical potential and measuring, I can also change the magnetic field. And I change the magnetic field, more levels leave the occupied region. Okay? I make this separation larger and larger, and eventually this level will leave. So, and this actually gives me the staircase. And it turns out, okay, so maybe if I want to put, I need to put 1 over B here, or I can put B and the resistivity instead of conductivity. And it turns out that if you look on the other hand of, on the, yeah. Less. Yeah. So basically, if I could increase the magnetic field a lot, which is done in many experiments, I get that only the lowest lambda level is populated.
Yeah, but if you increase it even more, you just elevate.
Yeah. And it turns out that sigma xx, whenever we're going through these steps, sigma xx is non-zero, but anywhere else it is zero. And this is not very surprising, because if you put the chemical potential between lambda levels, you're in a gapped system, right? There's a full level. There are a number of full levels and many other empty levels. This is not a conducting state. If you remember that from band structures, it's the same. You have a band insulator when your chemical potential is between bands. Nothing can move. You can apply magnetic field. States just map into themselves because of the periodicity. And say the states in momentum space are kind of moving, but then in the end, the state that you moved from one edge just goes to the other edge of the dispersion. So your average momentum is zero. Okay? and this is very similar here. So we're not surprised that sigma xx is actually zero, but it has these spikes. And let me just, in the time we have left, just convince you that this is actually the correct thing to expect, even in, you know, not this hand-waving classical argument. So the way to do that would be the following. I just want to add magnetic field to my, electric field to my Hamiltonian that already has magnetic field. And see what happens. Yeah.
Are you sure of the sigma xx plot? Because generally there are edge states and there is a conductivity that is high during that constant or on the network. But sigma xx, no,
so
R xx.
The resistivity has the same. The resistivity has the same picture, basically. So there is that's confusing, but in this case the resistivity also has the same profile. It becomes high on the staircases. It becomes non-zero on the staircases.
I understand that it's due to the impurity.
Okay, we'll get to that when we add impurities, and then we'll see, because we actually only have extended states on the Landau levels, but. We'll get to that. Okay, so what I want to do is take my Hamiltonian that we had before. X plus squared. What I want to do is I want to add an electric field in the x direction. So the easiest thing for me to do would be to complete the square. So, okay. So let's do it this way. So it's EBX 2m. I just want to write it like that. Plus PY plus, let's say it's alpha E squared minus some constant. Okay, so I just want alpha E times EBX times 2 divided by 2M to be EEX. Okay? So I'm just completing the squared. So bear with me for a second. So what I get is that my alpha is actually m over b. So this shift that I have is m e over b. Okay? This is, so what I did is I put everything inside and I'm calculating this. There's another piece here, which is proportional to basically p squared. I think. Let me just see. Yeah, to p squared. So let's just. Leave A for now. Yeah, it's proportional to P squared, but we'll, we don't care so much about that. What I want to say is that if I want to calculate the current in the y direction, what I need to do, or let's is calculate the average of the momentum in the y direction. Okay? So what I want to do is basically take my state and apply and find what is the PY expectation value, And then I'm going to multiply by the degeneracy of the level and calculate. But this PY operator should be the canonical momentum. So it should be basically psi, let's call it psi k, because this is how we call PY. And it's going to be the PY operator minus EAY. So okay, but you remember that these are Gaussians, right? They go like e to the minus x naught squared, right? These are Gaussians, and actually, these are Gaussians with the additional. So, okay, let me do this. So, psi k is a Gaussian with x plus x naught that we had before, which was just kLb squared, plus x1, which is 2lb squared, and x1 is what we found, which was me over b. Okay? So these are shifted Gaussians. If they were all only shifted by this, this will have no expectation value. Because the thing I'm writing here is actually the same as x plus x naught squared over x plus x naught. So it's like for this distribution, if I do this integral, I get a zero, okay? Because my distribution is just symmetric around zero. In our case, we shifted, so it's symmetric around this, okay? So actually, I can write it this way. It's psi k py minus ea, and I can add the m over e, m of m e over b times e b psi k, and then minus that same part, so m e b e. Sandwich between the wave functions. So basically, this first term just cancels because of the symmetry of the Gaussian, and all I have is this offset, but this offset is constant. So I can, in the end of the day, see that I have this constant, and let me just check that it's the right constant, psi k, and this is normalized, so this gives me 1. Let me just see that I have the right constant. I messed up the constant, but this is the average, and therefore J in the y direction would be ME over EE over B for this, and I have to multiply by the number of Landau levels, and you see that it will be the same for every Landau level, because it's always a Gaussian times a polynomial. And times E, basically, and divided by M, times E over M. And if you do this correctly, you'll just get, again, that sigma xy is what we had before, E squared over H. So you'll actually get that the quantum consideration gives you the same thing. Now, where is that coming from, and why do we have just one quantum state effectively for each Landau level? You can think of it, again, semi-classically in the following way. And this is just a cartoon. But what we had, you can think of classical orbits everywhere. And maybe it's not a bad picture because our states are really localized and are the quantum analogs of these. But if you look at this, on the edge, there would be orbits that don't close. And this is the direction of current. So now, what happens if I'm applying, let's say I'm applying an electric field in this direction, all I'm doing is changing the population, and we'll talk about it tomorrow a little bit, but I'm just changing the occupation of states. So then, whatever I do in the bulk doesn't matter, because these states don't give any currents. They're closed orbits. But the open orbits do matter. So if I populate this more than that, I get current, but the current is in the y direction. It's not in the x direction. So this here we're starting to understand that the edges are actually very important here. Because they're populated equally.
So
they... There will be current. Actually, that's right. There will be current. So any quantum Hall system, if you could detect, you'll see that there's a current circulating the edge.
So, I mean, like, how strong is your current? By changing the electric field, you take, like, electrons, basically. I mean, you take a state from the right-hand side into the left-hand side, right?
Yeah. This is the relationship. I have only one state for each Landau level. Only one edge state, or if you think of a geometry where this is infinite, so I have two. But there's only one state for each, so it's a small. So the E squared over H, or let's say H over E squared, which is quantum of resistance, is 13 kilo ohm. So it's very large resistivity. It just happened, okay, that if your sigma xx is 0, rho xy is the reciprocal of sigma xy. And it's a big resistivity. So this is how much you get. So even though you have a bulk system, you have only one state circulating the edge. There's no net current. So you can use this only if you apply current in a certain geometry. Only if you can, you know, apply voltage and measure on the other side, then you can see it. Okay, so this is thinking about this comes from thinking that you have filled Landau levels. If you decrease the magnetic field and you have more Landau levels, you'll have more of them, but only if you fill an integer number of them. If you're in the middle of a Landau level we didn't discuss that. But basically, we'll see that you can change the chemical potential of the magnetic field continuously, and usually instead of delta functions, you'll have something like that, where the states here are extended, but the states here are localized by impurities. So again, we'll only have, you know, sharp transitions. And we'll see that all of that doesn't matter because these are edge states, and the topology, which we'll get to in the end, dictates that we have to have them. So even if you disorder the system, so maybe they won't go straight on the edge, maybe we'll have to do some other trajectory, but they will be there. They have to be there. And you'll always have the same. So that's also, I think, amazing to see. There are pictures of the samples that people used to do quantum Hall effect, and this was 30 years ago. And when you look at the setup, it looks like nothing accurate can come out of that. It's way less beautiful than samples we have today, and leads are attached with some, you know, blobs of things soldered on the system, and yet you get amazing precision for this quantity. And the reason for that is that really only the edge modes contribute here. And the edge modes just have to be there. And there's only one for each Landau level. So, yeah, you can look at, this is from one, I'll put it online, but there's from one of the experiments. You can see the staircase, and you can see the, this is actually resistivity, rho xx and rho xy. So amazing. And for the fractional quantum Hall effect, we'll see what happens. But this is only when there are interactions, and everything we did today is without interactions, so you just only expect the edge modes to give you something. Any more questions? Okay.